Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I'm your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Daniel Needham from Morningstar. You can read his official bio in the show notes. Suffice it to say, Daniel's very legit. He was a blast to talk to. I met him at the Future Proof conference out in LA that we were both at, and it was a good time. Thanks to Jake Taylor for making this one happen. I appreciate it. As always, none of this is financial advice. All the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions and do your own due diligence. That's all I got for this intro. Shout out to the Aussies that listen. Daniel's from down there. I hope to see y'all again sometime. It was a hell of a visit when I had one. Without further ado, enjoy the show. Excited to be joined by Daniel Needham today. We met at Future Proof. So you were on the big stage. We being Toby, Jake, and I got a... I like to think of it as the equivalent of the Friday afternoon show at Lollapalooza. We were just kind of filling some space. But I had a great time, man. That was fun.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Thanks for having me, Bill. Yeah, it was great to meet in person as well. And so I've listened to a few of the three of you on podcast together and had a chance to listen to your Business Brew as well. So it was actually great to meet, you know, a few folks I've admired over the years in person. So, and it was a lot of fun. I think having conferences on Huntington Beach could become a little more popular after that.
Yeah, that was a nice backdrop, wasn't it? I mean, if people want me to broadcast from the beach, I'm happy to do that anytime.
Exactly. I could get used to it.
Yeah, that was sweet.
Yeah. So
do you, you know, people may not know who you are. Do you want to go through your background a little bit? And obviously you're sitting in front of the Morningstar background, but that's where you are now. But how'd you get where you are?
Yeah. So I've been at Morningstar since 2009, but as you can tell from my accent, I'm from South Bronx, New York, and a little further south. So I grew up in Sydney, about 45 minutes out of Sydney, and started working in the industry straight out of at a university. Went to Sydney University and worked for a year and a bit for a European insurance company, and then started as an analyst at an institutional investment advisory firm in Australia called Intech Investments. And started as an analyst and, you know, really working with large DB funds and government entities like treasury corporations and large insurance funds. And, you know, just love the research side of things, you know, working on capital markets research and working with these large firms on how to allocate their capital to meet their liabilities. And so that's how I got in the industry and moved into the portfolio management area. I think it must have been about 2005, and did that for a while. A lot of time on multi-asset and, you know, really looking at, you know, cross-asset classes, within asset classes, you know, private markets, things like that. And did that until, you know, I became CIO in about, I think that was, I should know this now, but 2008, actually, yeah. My mentor and former CIO of the business didn't come back from holidays, retired in the beginning of 2008 and handed the keys over. So I got to oversee an investment team during the global financial crisis.
Yeah, that's interesting timing, right?
That's right. I would have probably, you know, not picked that year to start, but you know, they say, yeah, experience isn't measured in years; it's measured in intensity. So I feel like I got a decade in that 2 year period, and so yeah, so I was CIO and was managing portfolios as well, and then Morningstar bought the business in 2009, July 2009, and so came across.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and so joined Morningstar from there. And, you know, there's a few points in your life where you get lucky, and one of them was meeting my wife. And you know, we looked at different places that Intech could land, but Morningstar has been, you know, far and away the best option and one of the best outcomes for, you know, for me and the team, I think. So, yeah, so it was there 2009 and then spent a couple of years in Australia and looking after the Asian operations for the investment management business, and then moved to London for a couple of years, moved there in 2013, sort of looked after the investment business there across Europe, and then in 2015 moved to the US, took a role as president of the investment management group and chief investment officer. You know, hadn't really appreciated how cold the Chicago winters were until...
Dude, it's a different level.
That's right. You think, you think London would set you up, but it just doesn't prepare you. So, yeah. So
I spent 17 years in Chicago.
Yeah.
And for the first three, I didn't see a summer. So the first two summers, I was actually gone.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm doing this wrong.
Yeah, I'm not surprised by that. I'm just fascinated so many people live here, given the winters. But so that's been great, you know, and so had great opportunity to work with all the great research teams across Morningstar and build solutions for clients and build strategies. You know, I've always had a hand in portfolios, but the last year I stepped away from sort of the chief investment officer role and took on sort of leadership for Morningstar's wealth management solutions group, which is, you know, part of Morningstar that provides services to financial advisors, individuals. So we have a platform, we have investment offerings, we have a portfolio accounting reporting software business. We have an aggregation business by all accounts. And we also have the individual business, which is all the Morningstar.com, all of the research subscription business, our public sites. So that's my job now. And so, you know, I kind of handed over, transitioned out of the investment roles and handed the portfolios over, and we've got a great team. So, you know, it was easy to do from that perspective. But, you know, kind of as you would know, being an avid investor, you know, it's in your blood and in your DNA. So you never really leave it.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you miss it at all? Or, I mean, obviously it's a new challenge, right? But
that's right.
Slightly different.
Yeah, you know, I'm a kind of, I love to learn new things. And so always in investing, you're always kind of trying to understand different elements of the market, what's changing. And so the challenge of learning, you know, new things. And I'm always struck, you know, everybody knows the Buffett quote, like, I'm a better investor because I'm a businessman. I'm a better businessman because I'm an investor. And so it definitely, spending more time on, you know, strategy, competitive analysis, capital allocation, execution, it's actually really, you know, we always did a bit of that with the investment management business, but when you run a larger team, a larger group, and you're in multiple industries and you've got more technology related products, it just becomes really fascinating to see all of those choices that you need to make. And while strategy is obviously, you know, critical, execution also, you know, is just so important. So that's been really fun to learn you know, I still manage my own portfolio, but it just means I can't talk about the stocks, my own personal stocks anymore. So, whereas when you're running a strategy, it's easier to talk about what you're up to.
Yeah. I'll tell you, at least on the consumer focused part of Morningstar, I remember, what was it, 2 years ago, there were very, very few 4 and 5 star stocks, and it's abundant right now. A lot of the fair value uncertainties are deemed, you know, high or whatever, but there's some wide moat cheap stuff out there, according to y'all's definition. So it's should theoretically be a better time to be buying assets than it was, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think if you look at our 5 star, that's one of the things I look at as a way of assessing, you know, the attractiveness of the opportunity. And there's always a little bit of a lead lag where, you know, as you mentioned, the uncertainty around the fair values, things change, you know, you've got to adjust your fair value, but even accounting for that, you know, it is the Morningstar equity research team really seeing way more opportunities. And so, which is, you know, constructive. And so if you're a speculator, you know, this is probably, you know, it's hard to get out of bed in the morning, but, you know, if you're a long-term investor, you feel the pain of the portfolio losses, but also the, you know, a more constructive forward opportunity set. So, you know, our research, without sort of getting too promotional, but, you know, our public, yeah, the research subscription gives you access to, you know, all the equity analysts, and they're the same analysts that we use when we're building institutional, you know, professional portfolios. And so there's like 100-person analyst team covering 1,500 stocks. And because they, you know, as you know, the economic moat research, it's, you know, they're good businesses generally, like to get a moat rating. So they're the kind of businesses where you can buy and generally hold them for a long period of time, which is often a better way of investing for most people.
Yeah, I don't mind promoting Morningstar. I like what y'all do. I think it's good. From what I understand, the way that the company was built was very cool. I like that it's a Chicago company. I've used the product for a while. I like it as a more or less like a hunting ground and idea generation. Sometimes I think if I allow myself to shortcut my own thinking when I was a little younger because like somebody else said something, but you know, that's a problem everywhere. That's not unique to any one product, right? You got to think for yourself.
Yeah, that's the key to investing, especially when things change.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, you mentioned that you came in 2008 and or that you started being an investment officer in 2008. I'm curious, you know, this has been a market that I think has confused a lot of people. Some of the people that I've spoken to have said it's the hardest market they've seen since 08. I'm curious to hear you riff on a little bit what the differences or similarities that you're seeing are, and just kind of how you size up where we are as a, you know, financial, our well-being in general, and then kind of what you see going on, if you don't mind.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is quite different to 2008. You know, it's easy now to look back at 9th of March 2009 and kick yourself, go, well, why didn't I buy more there? Or, you know, from the end of September to you know, really late February, early March was, I mean, at times there were really rational reasons for why the financial system should collapse. And so it's, you forget that kind of, you just tend to remember the missed opportunities. Why didn't I buy more? You know, why didn't I lend investment grade corporate debt at crazy spreads? But the world was very different. And, you know, we went on a path thanks to, you know, really aggressive and unconventional government policy. And so I view this as quite different. It's possible that, you know, there's some hidden risk somewhere that, you know, rising interest rates trigger, but the quality of the banking system around the world is just completely different. And, you know, the frustrations that Jamie Dimon feels not having to hold so much capital is one of the reasons why collectively this is a much better cycle. So, I think for me, it's quite different, but each of the cycles. So I came into the industry at the end of, you know, the tech bubble before, you know, the economy and the markets sort of dropped. So I came in for the sort of bear market of that, and then had that, you know, the global financial crisis, and then a few of the other little blips of, you know, the European crisis and the emerging markets crisis, or if we call it that. And then, you know, then COVID and now this. And so there's been a number of sort of those periods through time. And when we were looking back in 2000 and leading up to 2008, we were looking at different scenario models to, you know, to build within a multi-asset setting. Like, what does bad look like? And I remember we picked 93 to 94, and because it was kind of a funny period, because that was the last time real rates had been increased really fast. And so that was our kind of scenario where we felt like everything goes bad if that happens. And so we'd always kind of been aware, our team, especially the core of the team that's in different parts of the world now, that real rates are the killer, right? They kill everything. And if you go back and look at the year of 1994, everything lost money. Looking at, you know, sub strategies and asset classes, it was just a really tough period. And we're in that kind of period now, right? I think that's actually probably one of the most similar periods where, interest rates were really aggressively increased. I think they doubled. I think the short rate got to 8% pretty quickly. And that's because you had a central bank that could remember, you know, there was institutional memory of what it was like getting inflation down. And, you know, Volcker's a pretty, you know, terrifying individual if you're an investor of bonds. And so I think that's probably the most similar period. And but you know, that turned out to be you know, that was coming out of the savings and loans crisis in the late 80s. And so there was a bit of a, you know, some challenges with some of the balance sheets of the banking sector. And so there were some innovative tools that the government used to deal with some of the bad debts and you know, sell them off. So I think that's probably the most similar in a way. But inflation's obviously, you know, really accelerated. So I actually think it's a pretty attractive investment environment at the moment, relative to where we've been in the last, you know, decade. There's been bits and, you know, periods of time where there's some attractive points, but to me, this is particularly attractive. It's quite painful and it could get worse. You know, inflation could be stickier than what people are maybe hoping for, and rates may need to go much higher. But you know, quality of companies, you know, especially in the US, is just really probably as high as it's ever been. And central banks and governments probably have a better handle on how to deal with crises than they ever have. And maybe they got a little heavy-handed with the medicine this time. But, you know,
yeah,
I probably learned the low, you know, being a multi-asset investor, you can't help but spend more time on macroeconomics. It's kind of like a necessary evil. And once you spend a bit of time on it, you realize it's an incredibly messy area where there isn't really a consensus on anything. and at microeconomics, there's more of a consensus, I think. And certainly there are elements of macro where maybe there is, you know, let's say agreed areas. But it was all about inflation. I remember in 2010, it was like, hyperinflation's coming, The US government, I mean, S&P, I can't remember the exact year, S&P downgraded, the US Treasury effectively. So it was a crazy time. And so everybody was really worried about inflation coming out of that. And it didn't eventuate, right? And in fact, we were in this kind of what got dubbed secular stagnation towards the end of the cycle. So this is quite different in that regard. Like we've got a period where, but I remember back then that it was, we're going to have hyperinflation and, some people were kind of talking about the Weimar Republic and all of that kind of thing, and turned out to be completely wrong and almost the opposite of what happened.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think some of those conversations are still going on. And then the dollar is the best asset to own by far this year, it seems like, right now.
That's right.
I guess that's what happens in global slowdowns. But it's certainly an interesting observation. When COVID hit and all the spending came out, I think that the idea of buy the dollar would have been one of the last things that crossed my mind. And maybe that's because I'm not a very good macro guy, right?
But, yeah.
I think a lot of people got caught off sides. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I think so. So coming out of the global financial crisis, the US moved the fastest, like that of the developed economies, maybe outside of Australia, but Australia was saved by the terms of trade and exporting a ton of coal and iron to China. But they were out of the gates the fastest. They were the most unconventional. They cleaned the balance sheets of the banks up as quickly as they could. They were the most aggressive with monetary easing. And so the US dollar, really fell first, right? You had the short cover, you had the short squeeze on the dollar because everyone was sort of short dollar debt. And so this huge deleveraging pushed the dollar up, but then the dollar came down heavily and people were kind of calling the end to the dollar. And so what's interesting about the last cycle was the sequence of the policy responses. Like there wasn't that kind of coordinated response at the same time. The US went first. Then Japan went and, UK, Europe really dragged their heels, but finally did it. So you had this uncoordinated sort of devaluing of the currencies. And so in some ways, the US cleaned their balance sheet up and then had the, because they could deal with a sort of a depreciating dollar. This time, it's way more coordinated, which makes the impact on the global economy probably way more material. So whereas previously, you had sort of, uncoordinated easing that kind of staggered, and it kind of felt like it lengthened the cycle out quite a bit. Whereas this time, everyone's tightening, or almost everybody's tightening at the same time, and it's just economies are big and complex, and the tools and models that are used are generally equilibrium models, which don't really explain how the world works. And so, when you get these kind of, I think what Charlie Munger would call them, Lollapalooza effects. That's what kind of probably keeps me a bit more. I don't think the financial system's in anywhere near the kind of risk level it was, not even remotely as it was in 2008. But this kind of coordinated rate increases at the same time, who knows what can happen. So there's always that tail risk out there.
Something that I've been just sort of thinking about a lot is, Europe looks like it's not exactly set up for a great year of economic activity. China, I noticed the housing headlines, and basically the thought that I get to is like, how sick can the world get before the U.S. catches a cold as well? And then I look at all the labor numbers and I look at, the tax receipts that are coming from wages, and I throw my hands up because I say, I just don't know, right?
Yeah.
Like, it seems like for the first time in a long time, labor is actually winning. And to me, that's probably not the worst case scenario. It may not be great for asset valuations in the short term, but I think like if you want a healthy US and you think terminal value should be based on that or whatever, like it seems like long term, this is not the worst outcome in the world. But I wonder what I'm missing.
Yeah, I mean, I share that sentiment. I think the the dividing up the pie and households and labor getting a higher share is probably a more sustainable sort of outcome. It hurts corporate profits. I'm not sure it's been the labor market that's really been driving the inflation up. I think there's a lot of other factors as well. But yeah, it's we had the jobless recovery in 2000, you know, after the GFC, and now we have kind of like, you know, a job boom recession fear. So it's it leaves me less concerned from a, you know, from a macroeconomic perspective. Not that it would necessarily change the way I invest, but you know, if I think about how bad this could get, you've got households that are in pretty good shape. Sure, you know, not as good as maybe what we thought they were. Banks pretty good shape. You know, unemployment's low. You know, it operates with a lag and with the coordinated responses. Maybe you see it jump quickly, but you know, you're not going to have that sort of, you know, residential property overhang where there's just a massive oversupply of houses in the US. Now, you know, I think I grew up in Sydney and, you know, I know the Australian property market pretty well, and I lived in London and I know the London market pretty well. And, you know, these are markets where there's an undersupply of property. When there's an undersupply of property, it just creates a different dynamic for owners. And so, yeah, the property market's way different than 2008, 2009, where you had that really long overhang of lots of houses underwater. So yeah, I think we're probably in the best shape we've been for this kind of, you know, tightening-led recession in the US. And maybe it doesn't turn out to be that kind of as painful as what it might appear given the level of the rate rises.
Something that I do worry about, just like from a human perspective, is a dollar that's this strong, what does it do to emerging markets and their ability to like actually feed themselves and whatnot? I mean, and then kind of what tail risks get created out of that. But I don't know. I mean, I get to thinking of these thoughts and then I'm like, well, my brain naturally goes to like the downside paths.
Yeah.
And I try to remind myself there's a lot of paths in a Monte Carlo simulation and they're not all down. Right. So maybe think of the upside too, even as hard as it could be to fathom.
I think that's a great mental model to have in your head. I just think, you know, thinking about a range of outcomes, that's what the future is. You'll be on one path, but no one knows as well, right? Like even the person, maybe even more the person that's got a PhD in economics probably doesn't know. And so, yeah, we're in that period. My sense of the emerging market economies is that they've become more resilient and less dollar dependent than what they were when you had the sort of taper tantrum. So you've got probably, you know, maybe a more resilient economic structure in some of those markets. But you're right. I think probably the driving up of the dollar cost of commodities, foods, things like that really squeezes the less well off folks in those societies. So going into 2008, I don't know if you remember, but you know, it was inflation. People were worried about commodity inflations, particularly food price. You know, so corn and wheat, and you know, there was that was the main concern. I remember in those quarters going in before Lehman went down was inflation in the emerging world. And I think the Australian government at one point going into July of 2008. You know, market was expecting Australian rates to get up to 8%, and by the end of the year, they were getting cut heavily. So, but yeah, we get these periods, I think, and yeah, the strong dollar definitely has a lot of negative consequences. But overall, I'm pretty optimistic longer term. You know, I think that you know, we have these recessions, and you know, sometimes there's a lot of pain involved. But coming off a pretty low unemployment rate here, it's probably going to, you know, it's probably going to be a manageable outcome for most.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me business cycles absolutely suck to live through, but I don't know how many people have been proven to be good at dancing in and out of markets when they forecast a business cycle to come. It strikes me as a skill that very, very few have, but people like to think maybe they do. I've just completely given up, much to my dismay this year. And maybe next time, when I can like actually feel the greed in my body, I'll have the guts to sell. But it, you know, I think the thing that's hard about investing is you can say, well, wasn't it obvious that some of that bubble stuff had to pop? And I would say what was obvious to me is that on average, the returns would not be good, but I didn't know what the paths looked like to get to bad returns, right? So I guess the counter is bubbles always pop, but yeah. It's just not clear that it wasn't going to just be a period of very bad sort of forward return.
Yeah.
Now I'm hopeful the kids that are saving these days are going to have better forward returns and can maybe afford homes and whatnot. Like, this is a good thing, I think.
Yeah. I think for those that are saving, building wealth longer term, I think it is a good thing. But nobody knows, right? Like, I think life is lived forwards and learned backwards, and things always seem way more obvious after the fact. And it's hard. I think it's just the way that our minds work. We forget a lot of the important stuff. But I agree with you. I think, generally keeping, staying invested is, generally like the best approach. And those that try to time markets and move in and out, I'd be very surprised if people that do that make any money from it. It's just really hard to do. And markets are pretty efficient, where they need to be. And so, when you look back through history, like, especially if you look at what you would call, say, time series analysis versus cross-sectional analysis. So going back and looking, you'll see these things like, wow, that was a real anomaly. But when you go back and look at the cross-sectional opportunity set, it's not so obvious. Like, markets are good at pricing in consensus, and consensus is pretty good most of the time at reflecting the best guess that a bunch of people have. It's not always right, but it's nowhere near as mispriced as it looks when you go back and look at the time series stuff, or you remember it. It's a much, much tougher game than it appears in the numbers.
I think I know what you're saying, but can you explain that to me? Like, I'm five, like the cross-sectional analysis that you're saying. What exactly do you mean by that?
So if, at the end of the day, investors have a choice. You've got to choose. You've got to put your money somewhere. You can put in cash, bonds, corporate bonds, equities, real estate. And so when rates are low, it's not like people sit around and say, well, I'm going to own equities like I think they should be priced like they were when rates were high, right? Markets equilibrate, right? They mm-hmm. like, they're not, they don't price necessarily like the way I think that the traditional finance maybe posited a couple of decades ago, but they equilibrate. So if cash is giving you 1%, then the yield curve is probably going to be priced in a way that reflects, some incremental return, and it's going to be rate expectations and, some kind of premium for inflation uncertainty. But effectively, assets get repriced across the opportunity set. So if you just go back and look at, equities, through time, you say, wow, that looks like an outlier. But you got to look at the cross section, like what was available. Huh. And so,
yeah, that makes sense. So you'd want to, if I'm saying the CAPE is super high today, you might want to say, okay, well, relative to the opportunity set at the time,
that's right.
What was, yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
And so, go back and say, well, was the CAPE high at 22 when rates were, near zero versus, CAPE was 16, but, you're getting paid 8% to lend money to the government. Like, it's not a guarantee. Like, when you look at the opportunity set, at the time, it's never as obvious as it looks when you go back and look at individual pieces of it. So, like, people would say, well, the funny thing, I always love this, bonds are in a bubble. Like, US treasuries are in a bubble. Well, I don't understand how, treasuries could be in a bubble, right? The price, like, if you hold the bond to maturity, you get paid the yield. Like, so,
yeah.
Like, what are you really saying? What you're saying is you think interest rates should be way higher than the conditions. Okay, well, but that's a different mechanism. That's not necessarily mispricing. That's the market's expectation of inflation and what the central bank's going to do. And so you get these kind of funny periods where, I don't think it's possible to say treasury bonds are in a bubble because I look at asset classes. This maybe get a little kind of weird, but I'll say it anyway.
No, I like this. Let's get weird.
So, I have this idea that, and it's probably not my idea, but just picked it up, but there's assets that have limited supply, and there's assets that have infinite supply. And obviously, nothing really has infinite supply. But for short periods of time, it might as well be infinite. So the U.S. dollar. So if you're a monetary sovereign like the U.S. government, there's an infinite supply of U.S. dollars if needed. The Swiss government, did the same thing with the Swiss franc when they were worried about the Swiss franc getting above the euro a few years back. So anything that's available in financial markets in U.S. dollars, the U.S. government can buy. treasury instruments like the notes and the bonds are just another form of instrument that the US government could buy infinite amounts of. So you know, the US government only has to threaten to do something, to buy something that they don't even actually have to buy anything. It will influence the price because you can't beat them. You know, they can just add supplies of dollars or reserves or bonds. Like the supply demand dynamics, like buying pressure and, you know, short squeezes and all those things, it just doesn't apply to those instruments. And so, whereas I think where you have private balance sheets that are constrained, or you have governments that don't issue their own currency or are tied to another currency, then you have balance sheet constraints. Then you have liquidity issues that matter. So that government bonds may get illiquid because the inventory levels that are held by the bond traders and things like that, but that's a very technical type of illiquidity. But when you're dealing with like a corporate bond of a private company in US dollars that can go bankrupt, and there's a limited number of bonds on issue or a company that has a certain number of securities on issue, then you can get these kind of, you know, buying pressure type stories, liquidity type stories that really, and that's where contrarian investing, I think, works the best. And so, you know, using a contrarian mindset to securities that are issued by a monetary sovereign that can issue and buy as many of them as they want, it's just that doesn't really matter unless you're a really short-term technical trader. So,
Now the limitation on that would be, I guess, so if you're saying that the government can buy as many notes as are issued, I would say that the limitation is the rates. But if they're the buyer, then they can kind of set that, right?
So yeah, it's, I mean, I think
what is the limitation? There must be some limitation to this thought, right?
I mean, I think, you know, this is where there was a lot of, the modern monetary theory school came out. And if you go back and read the transcripts or listen to, you know, Berkshire Hathaway meetings, you know, Buffett's talked about the US government can't go bankrupt. Like if you print your own, when he was contrasting the US system versus Europe in the European crisis, he made all the similar points that the MMT guys are making, right? Like, you know, the US government is not going to, like other than Congress, the US government's not going to default on their debt, right? They, you know, the Treasury just transfers money. Like what happens when the Treasury like sells when the Treasury and the Fed are working together, it's left pocket, right pocket kind of movement. So it's just a very different, the world changed in the early 70s, fundamentally changed. You know, monetary sovereigns like the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, Japan. Japan is a classic example. They just operate differently to the gold standard frameworks that most people use in their heads. And it's really remarkable. You still hear people talk about it. Now, that doesn't mean that governments can spend an infinite amount of money, or at the end of the day, the US government, if it spends, that's a dollar of spending in the economy. And, you know, when you add that with the private sector spending, that creates buying pressure that can, you know, if supply doesn't respond, then you're going to get inflation. And so the real risk for governments, government spending is inflation. It's not default. So if you're worried about, you know, the US government, creating too many reserves with the, you know, and funding spending for the government, it's going to come through inflation. It's not going to come through default, or, you know, and maybe that comes through the currency movements. But anyway, so, and it's kind of, I find that fascinating. I kind of learned that in the after the global financial crisis, that, you know, after reading a few different people, I was sitting there thinking, why isn't there inflation, and why aren't some of these countries going bankrupt? And you realize actually a lot of the kind of conventional wisdom that market participants use isn't actually sound, and it's a lot of shorthand and a lot of gold standard stuff. And but the world fundamentally changed in the 70s for when, you know, when people moved off the Bretton Woods model and everybody went to fiat currencies. It's very different.
Can you recall off the top of your head like who you would recommend reading to further understand? Or that helped you understand?
Yeah, I mean, you know
how this works.
Probably one of the best, you know. I feel like Hyman Minsky wrote a book called, he wrote the financial instability. He came up with the financial instability hypothesis, and he wrote a book on stabilizing an unstable economy. And probably, you know, Keynes and so Minsky wrote a book on Keynes. I think he wrote it in 75, but had some really important views. And I think when you go, once you start reading about macroeconomics, you've got to step back and go, okay, so economics was a humanities subject. It was political economy. And then it morphed into this kind of highly mathematical system. But when you're reading macroeconomics, you've got to recognize it. You know, politics and values, it's like the arteries are sort of, you know, they circle each other. And so it's really hard to separate them. So you've got to tread carefully when you read the different schools of thought, because often underpinning them is a sort of underlying set of economic values and beliefs, which makes it really hard to cut through the kind of what Charlie Munger would call the twaddle.
Good pull on twaddle, by the way.
Yeah.
I like it.
And so you've got to kind of tread carefully. And so, but I would say that Minsky's book on Keynes in the 70s was good. And Randall Ray, who's one of the MMT guys, he's done some good stuff on Minsky and money. And, oh gosh, there's another book. I'll share it with you after.
Yeah, I'll drop it in the show notes or whatever. It's just kind of interesting because, my brain, once upon a time, you know, I voted for Ron Paul and I was a hard money libertarian type, when I was a young kid, went to Auburn, the Von Mises Institute is there. So, it's sort of like in the, ethos at that school. But I've realized, that either that school of thought was very, very early or quite wrong. At the risk of upsetting some people that listen, I would argue it's probably not correct for like reality, right? I think it makes sense in theory, but it's not how the world actually works.
Yeah, Yogi Berra has that one, right? In theory, there's no difference between practice in theory and practice.
That's right.
And so
that's right.
I went through the same thing. I read a lot of Austrian. I read von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, and you know, I read a lot. I read across all the different schools, and I don't know. I feel like each of them has an element that's useful, but each of them has pretty substantial sort of flaws in them. And I think a kind of a synthesis of them can be helpful, but, you know, it's highly uncertain. It's very, you know, you're dealing with an area where it's really hard to be precise and, you know, it isn't kind of a hard science where you can do experiments and controlled experiments and things like that. But there's a bit in that. I think there's an element of really valuable insight in the MMT school that you can pull out. And so, Randall Ray has a good primer on money, which was useful. And I think they have the best handle of how the financial system and the economy actually work together and the banking system. And what does quantitative easing really mean? Well, it doesn't mean that any money, there's no money getting printed. I'll give you one before we move on, because I don't want to turn into too much of a...
I like this. I mean, if you want to talk this, I'll talk this for a while, because I'm still trying to get my head around how this stuff works.
Yeah. But so the idea of, you know, quantitative easing and is... you know, so the government effectively buys a bond in the secondary market and gives the participant, the dealer, treasury, gives them reserves, right? So treasury bond for a reserve. And so people get that's money printing, because effectively what happens is that the Fed can effectively create the reserves, right? They just type the numbers in. But what matters is the reserves in the system. So that bond was issued. So when it was first issued, right, the Treasury, the Fed on behalf of the Treasury, gave the Treasury bond in the primary market and got reserves, right? And so quantitative easing says, okay, now I'm going to go in the market, I'm going to buy the bond in the market, I'm going to give you the reserves. So outside of a liquidity spread and a repricing, the same amount of reserves are in the system. There's been no net money printing. That's quantitative easing. All you're doing is influencing the price of the instruments. You're not adding new reserves to the system. New reserves come into the system when the government spends money. The US government spends money into creation. They create reserves when they spend, and it gets credited into their bank with the Fed. So it's actually spending that creates the money, and taxes destroys the money. And so that's where the money creation is happening. But quantitative easing is just buying and selling different instruments. So it's really just a way of the government influencing the yield curve. It's not printing money. And when people say money printing and quantitative easing, it's not, I just don't think that's accurate. There's the impact of the reserves on the system is not there. So this is some of the insights I think the MMT guys are good at explaining. Now, some of their policy prescriptions, that's a whole other topic, but I'm interested in understanding how the world works, not what somebody's, you know, political values are or views. So anyway, but I found that really useful as an investor. But there's one soft currency economics. I can't remember the author now, but he's one of the guys that was one of the early MMT guys, and he was a hedge fund manager. So he was just trying to make money from the Italian bond market before the euro was created. And he was one of the guys that came up with this idea that, well, actually, Italy doesn't need help from the IMF because Italy can't default on their bonds. And he was quite right. And that, so it really took the financial markets a couple of decades to process the impact of moving off the Bretton Woods system to a fiat currency system. And it doesn't apply to all countries. You know, you need to have your own exchange rate. You need to be borrowing in your own currency. You need to be able to set your own interest rates. And so that's kind of the framework, which I found useful as an investor.
Yeah, well, if it's taken the financial markets a few decades, then I can forgive myself for taking a few years to not fully understand it, I suppose.
Yeah, me too. Again, whether I actually even understand it, I guess it's one of those things where we never really know. So.
Yeah. So you had mentioned earlier your thoughts on inflation. Do you attribute some of that to the additional government spending, or is it a supply side or a combination of both? Like, I'm curious to hear you, because the second thought in my head is I was just reading this Credit Suisse note on the Inflation Reduction Act and the amount of stimulation that will probably go into energy innovation. It's kind of in the back of my mind making me wonder if we're going to have more persistent inflation than may. I don't know that the title of the bill is something that I necessarily buy, but I don't know that I disagree with the bill itself. I think it could be good.
Yeah, I mean, I think it seems like there's a lot of good reasons to be looking at alternative energy sources, even if there's folks out there that you may be more skeptical on the climate side of things, but, you know, conserving, you know, valuable natural resources to be able to use more sustainable resources makes sense to me. That seems pretty logical. It's always hard to know what's driven inflation. To me, it's a combination of things. I think we have to step back and say what happened in 2020 was very unique. I don't know if you remember, you know, the sort of late February, early March of 2020. I'm sure you do, but it wasn't entirely clear what was going to happen with all these, you know, shutdowns, and so, you know, bond markets, like the trading of secondary bonds, was drying up, and you know, I'd say, you know, 23rd of March 2020. The week before that, it felt like the credit market door was, as Howard Marks would say, was kind of slamming shut. And so we'd never experienced that kind of coordinated economic shutdown of the economy before, you know, I don't think. And so that was just huge, right? So the question is, you know, I think Bridgewater was throwing this kind of comparison out. It's like, okay, you have it's how does an economy respond to a natural disaster? Versus how does an economy respond, markets and economy respond to global financial crisis? They're kind of, let's call it, the two extremes. Financial system could end versus, you know, bounces back super quickly, really V-shaped recovery. We just didn't know, right? But what we did see was that governments were starting to, you know, really aggressively act first.
Yeah.
Maybe imperfectly, but very quickly. But things could have really spun out of hand, not necessarily because of the pandemic, but because of the government's response to the pandemic and the impact on the economy and liquidity in all markets. So it got pretty grim there for that week before the 23rd. And so, but what you had was this huge surge in demand relative to a contracted supply. Effectively, supply shut down significantly. Labor supply was hugely constrained. You know, transportation, you know, shipping containers, manufacturing, everything just got squeezed. And whilst the government can respond quickly with stimulus to protect consumers and small business owners, corporations will react by, you know, cutting investment spending, pulling things back, you know, reducing employment. That lead lag effect of that's pretty long, right? Like, so consumer demand can snap back quickly because people had money, they were not fired, you know, they were furloughed, or more people kept their jobs because they could work from home. So demand held up, remarkably well. Like, the recovery in sales, in retail sales in the US, I just think I've never seen anything like it. I mean,
yeah, it was just, that was wild.
Unbelievable. And so you had the supply side is way more slow moving, right? It's the nature of things. Corporate investment takes time. When you reduce your capacity, getting it back up takes time. And so generally with recessions, demand slows and can maybe accelerates, but it's not that kind of, you know, the speed of expansion on demand aligned with the supply contraction. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that. that's going to be inflationary. And so the demand is supported by the available supply of goods, and supply can be expanded, but it just couldn't expand at the rate that the demand expanded because of the use of the government balance sheet. So that to me is a huge driver of the increase in inflation. It's very abnormal. But, you know, we're in a period of, you know, deflation largely in a lot of parts of the consumer market, certainly in the tradable goods sector. So I, you know, that's just going to take time for prices to come down. But I think, you know, the government, you know, creating incentives for people to not work and, you know, at really high levels of income, we hadn't seen that before. And maybe it was warranted, but whether the last couple of doses were a bit heavy handed, I think history will probably say yes. But a very unique set of circumstances, right? So, it's not like, you know, it was a hot labor market that's just slowly outstripped supply. It was supply just got crunched and it's just taking time to come back. And so that's my read on it. I think it probably makes sense for rates to be, you know, to slow the economy down on the margin to reduce some of the pressures. But there's some structural reasons that it happened that are not related to sort of, you know, the level of interest rates in the economy. That so I think there's a point where the Fed's going to be able to do something, central banks, but, you know, there's some supply driven elements of inflation that are hard to deal with, and they're just going to take time to abate, I think.
Yeah. It's been interesting to see too, like, you know, I guess the first two companies that I saw say we were way over inventoried was Target and Walmart. Now you've got Nike has some inventory issues, and I guess that's a little bit more of a, I guess they go through that a little bit more, but it doesn't shock me that they're going through it today. I remember talking to Toby and Jake when this was going on, or in 2020, and I was like, we're really going to shut down the economy like that. How does this play out? Yeah. And I think that I tell myself this story. I think it's close to reality. In a spreadsheet, it should work out. But then life is really, really messy. And it's really hard when everybody needs to get inventory at the same time. And then container ships are, you know, sitting off the coast, or there's China's doing is no COVID policy. Like, there's so many variables into a system that was running so efficiently that to expect it to go back to an efficient sort of homeostasis or whatever status quo quickly is like just not a realistic expectation. Yeah. And then I think as participants, we extrapolate a little bit too much. And I don't know. I've just told myself, just like, take a chill pill, read company reports. You know, we'll see in a year whether or not there's moves to make. But I don't think making moves today is the answer for me. You know, I other people can do what they want.
I mean, I think I spent a lot of time, you know, we talked a lot about the macro side of things, and you know, look, it's an interesting area, and what should you do about it? Like, that's the question. And so, you know, there's a few of us on the research, they're on the research team here. You know, we thought the tone towards fiscal policy was changing, and that some of the elements of, you know, the modern monetary theory were kind of wafting their way into different branches of government. And there's some elements of it that are pretty compelling, and I think there's elements where the Fed probably knew a lot of that stuff anyway, right? So but we felt like, you know, we're probably going to see some pretty big stimulus coming, and that the government was going to be less worried about funding it, and that you know, that you'd probably see some largesse. We weren't sure of it, but we felt probably on balance, and maybe that was recency bias because we'd all been spending our time reading and the stuff. But and so to me, it's useful in the sense that it helps you think about the range of outcomes. But it's not useful in the sense that it should determine your investment decisions. And so obviously the range of outcomes helps you size risk and think about things like that. But ultimately, you know, I think you want to be looking at the fundamentals. You want to be looking at cash flows. Having an appreciation for how bad could get, you know, probably helps you maybe how aggressive, you know, maybe more with sizing.
Yeah.
You know, but I, as an investment strategy where you kind of use the stuff that we've been chatting about to sort of run your strategy, I just don't think that's viable. And, you know, Keynes went from being, you know, a macro investor to being a bottom-up concentrated value investor, because he learned the hard way that you can't make money with it. It's, you know, maybe Bridgewater and Brevin Howard and firms like that can, but it's really hard to do. And so, you know, looking at the cash flows of assets, you know, looking at the, you know, discount rates and what you think is a reasonable rate of return and trying to be, you know, investing where you think you can see the returns, you know, that's way more important than thinking about, you know, monetary policy or, you know, fiscal policy and things like that. Like, if forecasting inflation is impossible, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's great. It gives you that sense of like a range of outcomes, but then thinking about where do I deploy my capital? What's the opportunity set I've got? What's the best use of my capital today? And not knowing what the opportunity set's going to be. And, you know, the range of outcomes is useful because it helps you maybe say, well, is this extreme relative to history? Like, is this actually a really great buying opportunity such that I probably should be willing to increase my position sizes and maybe be fully invested if I wasn't already? But to try to make money from trading, you know, bond markets and equity markets and currency markets, but based off macro views, I think is really hard to do. And I certainly don't have any edge in it. That I can tell you with certainty.
Something that we had talked about when we were emailing is you've spent time thinking about market efficiency and inefficiency drivers. And I don't want you to have to sort of retread on parts of the conversation if I didn't pick it up, but I was curious if you have like mental models of what you're looking for to find pockets of inefficiencies.
Yeah. Going back a little bit to the point I made around like infinite supply versus fixed supply of assets, like I just feel like trying to hunt for inefficiencies in government securities and things like where the government sets a price, I just think is a waste of time. You know, the properties of bonds, you know, treasury bonds that can't default in your own currency, pretty attractive, right? Good to have as a ballast in your portfolio. Maybe you want to be shorter term with bills. So securities that aren't backed by a public balance sheet, you know, so public equities, let's say. You know, I think the thing I look for is, I want to call somebody out. So Michael Mobison, which I know you know, like actually he's somebody who's written some of the best papers on market efficiency that I've read. So anyone, you know, just read Michael Mobison's stuff. But I think he does such a great job of taking academic research, practitioner research, and synthesizing things into new ideas. And so I think he's actually come up with a bunch of new ideas, not because he's done a lot of the primary work himself, but he synthesized them in a way that they can be used and help you make decisions. So you know, I think my thoughts on efficiency have been heavily influenced by Warren Buffett and Seth Klarman, people like that, but also Michael Mobison's research. And the thing I love about his research is I love his notes section. So, you know, if I read one of his papers, I might, you know, the next couple of months, I'll probably read two dozen sort of academic papers, you know, from, you know, some of the early papers on Social Security Research Network that are in his notes. And he's just such a well-researched. So I think Dan Callahan and he do their research together. So I think he did a really good job of laying out sort of, you know, market efficiency. And so I thought his papers really sort of helped understand that. He'd been writing about them for years. But so markets generally, you know, they don't operate like this equilibrating thing you get taught it in business school or a CFA, right? Like this idea of there being, you know, they're kind of efficiency seeking systems where agents are rational and markets are efficient. And if they're not efficient, the errors are random. And if they're not random, you know, arbitrages just clean them up straight away. That's not the case. That's not how markets work. Markets are populated by agents like ourselves who have their own information and look to buy securities based off that information. And, markets are generally efficient. They're hard to beat, I think. So, but when they become inefficient, it's mainly because of the way the agents are behaving. So you tend to get this period where, you know, the more that market participants start to do the same thing, think the same thing, the more that you see, you know, value investors go bankrupt and shut down or leave the market or turn into growth investors, you start to lose that diversity in the market. And so it's that diversity, the difference between the agents that drives that market efficiency. And so the diversity, I don't know if you've read Scott Page's The Difference. It's a book. It's the math of, he does a great job. I think he's at Michigan. He does a great job of outlining the mathematics of the wisdom of crowds. And he has this cognitive diversity theory and, you know, all that. But effectively, you know, Moberson does a good job of using the jelly bean jar experiment, which actually Jack Trainer did.
That's
right?
What I was thinking about as you were talking. I was like, oh, it's, you know, eliminating the value investors is like eliminating the low guesses for the jelly beans, right?
That's right.
And then all of a sudden you're guessing too high.
Yeah, if you've got investors that are both long and short, your value investors generally operate a bit like a thermostat, right? If it gets too hot, it sends them down, they'll short it. If it gets too cold, they'll go long and warm it up and push it back to that temperature. And so that's kind of how I think about, you know, there's a group of investors that use heuristics, which are the price falls, I buy, the price goes up, I sell, or, you know, they're rebalances, they're hedges. There's a bunch of participants that kind of behave like value investors, and there's a bunch of participants that generally, you know, they're more momentum oriented, you know, they'll push the price away. And so markets are made up of all these different participants. And when there's a good balance between them, prices are probably pretty right. But when you start to get these periods where, you know, there's an imbalance, that's when you can start to get inefficiencies. Now, individual stocks, because there's a wide range of variation, I think there's more inefficiencies at the individual stock level. Because once you start to aggregate them up, the inefficiencies average out. So the period of inefficiency at the individual stock level generally doesn't last as long, in my view. It's kind of, there's not as much space for the stock to blow out. Now, Tesla maybe is an example, the South Sea Bubble is an example, but they're very rare exceptions. You know, maybe GameStop and things like that. But generally, the inefficiencies at the stock level aren't all that long-lived. I think that's because arbitrage is easier at the individual stock level. You can find stuff that's similar to go long and short, so you can take advantage of it in a lower risk way. But once you start to get into industries or sectors or countries or asset classes, the mechanism of keeping prices roughly where they should be starts to go down, because it's much harder to hedge an industry bet or a country bet. And so arbitrage, so the bigger the asset class gets, the more different it gets to everything else, the harder it is to stand on the other side of it. And that's where I think you get these bigger sort of bubbles. And so assets like Japan from the 60s to 89 or whatever it was really hard to go short Japan, right? Like, what could you hedge it with? How do you hedge a short? Equities are overpriced. I mean, you know, you can't apply any leverage to that, right? So so a lot of leverages, a lot of arbitrages operate with borrowed money and other people's money. And so their ability to kind of stay in the game is dependent on their ability to keep their funding. And so my theory is that, you know, that has a big influence on price. So it's easy to say, you know, German equities are cheap, but, you know, how do you hedge it? You could probably do some industry hedges and use some, you know, you could probably pick a few stocks from around the world and go, you know, long Germany, but short a basket of stuff that you think somewhat similar. But you wouldn't want to put too much risk capital against that. I mean, you could get taken to the cleaners. So I think that has a big impact on market efficiency. At least that's how I think about it. So if you, some bets maybe look obviously cheap, but they could stay cheap for a long time and, you know, you could go bust or underperform. And so within public markets where market participants are playing, generally they're getting paid to win, but they're also getting paid to play. So there's a lot of money in the market that if everyone was living off their own excess returns, just wouldn't be in the market, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So there's a lot more competition in the market than is justified by the level of excess returns available, probably for those that are trying to compete with it. And so Stiglitz, there's some papers, you know, the impossibility of perfect markets. There's been a lot of theory around, you know, how inefficient should markets be? They should be inefficient enough that there's an incentive for people to make them efficient. And so, because people want to make money from, you know, and so that's the whole theory. And so there's a lot of models that were built around that. But I think Alfred Rappaport said that model would work if people were paid to win, but they get paid to play. So there's way more money out there chasing stocks than would be justified. So that makes markets pretty efficient, but it also makes them prone to these episodic periods of inefficiency. So what I'm looking for is where the money's moved away.
Yeah, interesting.
And there's a bunch of, we have a checklist that we use, but there's a bunch of things that I look at, like, you know, how does a, you know, trailing valuation metrics, flows, who owns the asset class, what do the consensus forecasts look like, sentiment indicators, bunch of stuff like that. But that's really generally for finding cheap asset classes, but you can use it to find places that you can avoid. And so, you know, generally that works pretty well, but markets are efficient, you know, they're hard to beat. So, you know, generally it's a tough game, whichever way you want to go.
Interesting. I like how you said the bigger the market, almost the more prone to inefficiency it could get, because my mind would tell you the smaller. But I understand what you're saying. If it's hard to hedge that much exposure, you can get something that just goes one way and it can't be arbitraged.
That's right.
Away. Yeah. So interesting.
So the three keys, you know, market efficiency, which is kind of the traditional school when they were getting attacked by the behavioral guys, was, you know, agents are rational. And yeah, if they're not rational, then the errors of those irrational agents average out. And if they don't average out, then, you know, arbitragers come and clean it up. And behavioral finance was able to show pretty convincingly that investors aren't rational. The averages don't cancel out and that arbitrage is limited. So this is what, you know, Richard Thaler did a lot of work on, which is around the, you know, arbitrage is limited. And, you know, you got the whole Palm Pilot, you know, all those examples everybody's heard of.
Yeah.
And so you get these periods. And Buffett said, you know, in one of his letters, I can't remember which one it was, but he said that, you know, academics were you know, early on, the idea that markets are frequently efficient was right, but it got taken to the extreme for them to be always efficient. And the difference between these two propositions is night and day. And so I think, you know, this infrequent inefficiency is what drives that. And so I did a fair bit of work into that. But generally there's that frequent, you know, they're frequently efficient. And so so generally it's better to assume markets are efficient. And then look for opportunities, you know, when they're not efficient. But recognize that it's a tough game and, you know, it's hard to win and you're up against a lot of smart people and the markets are pretty good at pricing consensus and current conditions. So if you feel like it looks obviously cheap, I would, instead of questioning consensus, I would question my own logic.
Yeah. Well, that's what I've been looking at more like smaller and medium sized businesses. And the first thing that I'm starting to, I have like on a checklist is why doesn't private equity own this already if it's like this cheap, right? I think there's just probably a safer question because then it's like, oh, there's some incentives here or whatever that I want to avoid. So, all right. So let's say I'm a listener and I'm an RIA and I'm listening to this. And I'm like, I really like Daniel. Pardon the ignorance of this question, but we didn't get to talk about it when we were in LA. What exactly does your group do?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we have a number of businesses, you know, in business lines in the group that I lead. But we have a TAMP, a turnkey asset management platform, where advisors, RIAs, and reps of broker dealers can implement their clients' portfolios on our platform. So we have individual equity portfolios, uses equity research as an input, but we have a team of PMs across, you know, different equity strategies. We have ETF managed portfolios where we're building multi-asset portfolios and we're thinking about some of the things I've been talking about, building diversified portfolios where we're thinking about long-term opportunities. And then we have some mutual fund portfolios and some fixed income portfolios. But we manage those strategies, you know, with a valuation-driven mindset. You know, how do we identify opportunities? How do we manage risk? How do we recognize markets are pretty efficient? And so that's one proposition. We also make our strategies available on third-party platforms. So, you know, InvestNet is more of a BD platform, but we're also available on Orion Communities. So generally, you know, set of equity portfolios, equity SMAs and ETF and mutual fund SMAs, they're the two main ways that folks can access the investment strategies that we manage. And, you know, we leverage Morningstar's research and then the rest of the stuff, you know, obviously our Morningstar.com is a place where you can get access to, you know, the security level research and fund level research that our research teams do.
Yeah. That's cool. So if I was an RIA and I was like, I kind of want to outsource some of my investment committee, things. I'm not saying that you can just like forget it, but it sounds like I could lean on some of what your group does for ideas and portfolio construction, whatnot, and get a Morningstar would maybe be a little bit more of my investment committee than if I was just on my own.
Yeah, I mean, you can use our research. You could use some of our strategies on the investment management side. You know, you could buy if you're an RIA and you want to do the asset allocation and you've got some managers you like to use, but you want an equity SMA, you could use our equity SMA and we have sub-advisory services where we can plug into your practice and you can use that And so generally we like to build long-term relationships with RIAs and firms we work with. So, you know, for firms that we work with, you know, they can, you know, they get access to our insights, you know, they get to meet with our PMs. And so, yeah, we generally are. Generally the advisors, they ask great questions and you know, we're able to provide them with insights and stuff above and beyond just the strategies we manage.
Yeah. It's a neat business, Morningstar is. I apologize for not knowing anything on the RIA side, but I am not one. So I just don't, you know, have that knowledge. But every interview that I have heard and the people that I've interviewed, I mean, Sanjay, Heather Brilliant, this guy Todd Wenning that I know.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Morningstar's got a hell of an alumni class, man. You guys must do something right. And you're in Chicago. So obviously I'm biased.
I'm biased too, but I agree with you. So, I think, you know, Morningstar was founded in 1984. Joe Mansueto, you know, he was an analyst at Harris, you know, Associates. So the Oakmark, you know, fund. So Dave Harrow and Bill Niger and that crew. So he started as an analyst there. And, you know, Joe's just thinks about business kind of, you know, he was, you know, selling sodas at high school in his dorm room and, you know, just a business guy. And, started as an analyst and you know, he looked at the information you got as an institutional investor looking at companies, and then he saw the information available to a mutual fund investor. He's like, wow, there's just not much available. And so he decided to build a business on collecting data on mutual funds and providing an objective source so investors could compare them across these different levels. And that's really where Morningstar started. It was like, how do you provide insights so that people can make better investment decisions? And we've always had this real mindset towards end investors. And so, you know, our mission is to empower investor success. And so we're all kind of generally fundamentally oriented, you know, investors first. You know, we probably all have, you know, secret, you know, collections of Berkshire Hathaway letters tucked away somewhere. And so, you know, there's definitely a field there. I should also say, you know, if it hasn't come through already, I think that, you know, I've learned a huge amount from, you know, reading Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger over the years, which I'm sure you have as well. And so
they're the best.
They are the best. Yeah.
I'll like, instead of podcasts, although everybody should obviously listen to all my episodes, but I'll just like, you know, churn through their old, annual meetings, you know, they have it in podcast form now.
I do the same thing.
I'll tell you what's embarrassing about it is I hear something, and even now I'm like, I don't know how many times I've listened, call it five or six. And I'm like, I didn't even understand that sentence until now. And then I find myself thinking, well, I probably don't even understand it right now. Like, what am I going to think it means, you know, next year or whatever? But
yeah, me too.
They are one of a kind, each of them in their own way.
That's right. And, you know, I think they've laid down an example for, you know, people to, you know, they answer honestly, they answer, you know, pretty, you know, frankly, and they're not there to sell people things. And so I think they set a bar for, you know, folks in our industry, even if they've probably been critical, you know, rightfully maybe to folks in our industry. So I think they're a great example. So whenever there's a new graduate that joins Morningstar and I chat with them, like, that's one of the top things I recommend. Go and read all the annual letters. And now back to 1994, all the Q&A is available on Spotify, which is, you know, remarkable, really, when you think about the wisdom that's packed in there. And I'm like you, you know, I'll listen to something, you know, I was listening to the 2010 one the other week, and I'm like, wow, these guys knew this. What's taken like me 20, 25 years to work out? I could have just shortcut and listened to it. As you say, I wouldn't have understood it, but yeah, it's really remarkable.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to think about how they built that business too. And like in COVID, you know, here's what I would associate as an industrial company, right? I mean, it's obviously a conglomerate, but the way that the insurance operation stepped up to give the company cash flow when some of like BNSF maybe had a tough quarter, and then how BNSF came back. It's like, man, this is just a beautiful, beautiful, I mean, he would call it a painting, right? Like,
yeah,
what he has assembled is so anti-fragile.
That's right.
And, you know, maybe some of the brands are tired, right? That if I was going to knock it, I would say that. But like, boy, it's incredible to see the end of his life's work.
That's right. And I think he's, the way that he's adapted to the conditions, like recognizing, you know, how do you deploy large amounts of capital as you get larger, and so BNSF and things like that, you know, and okay, maybe that didn't look good when I looked at the last 20 years, but what, how would it look if, you know, I controlled the capital allocation of that business and got to redeploy some of that somewhere else and let them invest in areas where they probably didn't last time, but it's really critical for their franchise. And so the way that he's learned and adapted, I think that's the key lesson that I've taken from it as well, is like, you know, you've got to learn and adapt. And he's just that, that's the classic example of how you do it for decades and decades. And, you know, the thing I, as an investor as well, he tells a lot, he says it a lot, but I don't know that everybody listens. It's like, he wouldn't do the same thing he's doing now if he was deploying the capital that you and I have got. Like, and so,
yeah,
and that's kind of, and I think the challenge sometimes is that, you know, people just sort of copy what he does versus how he thinks about things. And I think that's kind of as well, you know, he wouldn't be buying, you know, large, you know, I don't know that he'd be putting tons of money in some of the larger banks if he was, and maybe he would, maybe he loves Bank of America, but he's probably going to be doing something way more niche and, you know, looking for that dislocation, maybe what he was doing earlier in his career.
Yeah. I think something that I've realized as I've sort of grown as an investor is, it's really important, and I don't think it's knowable, but like when you look at what an investor does without being able to talk to them about why they're doing it. So like you look at his Occidental bet, I think it's easy to say, well, he's, you know, bullish oil. I mean, I don't know that that's actually true. Like, I don't know what he is actually trying to hedge within the portfolio or if he's even thinking that way. Or like, I you know, it's how it fits within Berkshire Hathaway Energy in the long term. I just don't, you know, I think it's so easy to look at an individual decision and say, he likes this. And
yeah.
I no longer do that. Just think
it's hard to work out.
It makes sense for him.
That's right. And where he's at and the work he's done. But, you know, that's a good example. So, but if you look at the economics of some of those businesses now, you know, the cash flow they're generating and, you know, the supply constraints that are supported by government policy. And so it does kind of, you know, can he look out the next 5 to 10 years and can he have a more informed view on the supply demand dynamics? He probably feels like he maybe does now. I don't know. I think it's hard to know, as you say, but, yeah, that's the fun of being a Berkshire shareholder as well.
Yeah. What did he say at the annual meeting? He said that he got interested when they announced that they basically wouldn't grow and they'd return a lot of the capital to shareholders.
That's right. And he said he
and
read
that's, that.
Yeah, he read it.
That's what he did with Apple too, right? When they did the big buyback, that's when I think he got like, okay, we can pile into this.
That's right. And he kind of read. I think he said he read an investor presentation that Vicky Golub, I think that's the name, put together, and he said it just made a ton of sense, and so I started buying. And the simplicity with which he explains things sometimes I think belies the level of thought that goes in. You know, he's just been doing it for such a long time, I have never been to a Berkshire Hathaway meeting, actually, so
you gotta come.
I've thought about it, you know, but you know, I'm not a big fan of crowds, you know, and
okay.
But I've read everything that they've, you know, like you would have as well. So, but maybe I will. But the commute and the, you know, the big crowds doesn't jump out at me.
Well, if they do it next year, I'm sure Jake will extend the invite as well. But I will take you around to some of the smaller crowds. I can't guarantee no crowd because everything is a crowded room. Yeah. But some of the events around the event, I think, make the event worth going to. I'm not a huge fan of sitting in the arena. If nothing else, it kind of freaks me out. I look at the board of directors and Buffett, and I'm like, I don't know that I want to be in this building, which is maybe not like the best thought. But I'm usually not in the building for the meeting. I try to go in, I see the movie, and then I usually end up leaving within. I have a spot that I sit in
that I
don't tell people about.
That's good. I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't get waken up at 4 to I know a lot of people do it. I just, it's not me.
Yeah.
I'd rather go out Friday night and meet people and then do my own thing.
Yeah. That doesn't, the dynamics of it doesn't appeal to me. But then, you know, when they were, you know, showing it on Yahoo, I think, first. And that was this, you know, for people like myself, who would rely on the notes, you know, from the different folks that would write the notes after the meeting. And that's a game changer. Now you can, you know, I'd be on the, you know, the L in on the red line on the way to work in Chicago, and I've got, you know, I'm listening to 2011, you know, annual meeting Q&A. It's like, it's a game changer. Now, you know, it's just so easy to get the information. So,
yeah. So you live in the city, I assume? You don't have to disclose where, but if you're riding the L, you're somewhere close.
Yeah, I'm up in Lakeview. Nice. Yeah, you can actually, from our, we've just got an apartment in a condo, and we've got there's a rooftop, and we can actually see Wrigley from our, when the lights are on and this, you know, the scoreboard's going. So it's a good spot. Nice, close to the lake. Great neighborhood up there.
I lived at 3660, that New Yorker building. That's the first place that I lived at.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And then I went around the city, spent some time in Old Town, Lincoln Park. But
yeah, great part of the city.
I miss it, man.
You got to swing by, drop me a line when you're in town. And yeah, it'd be great.
Oh, I will.
Great to 100%. Catch up. Yeah.
All right, cool. This is super fun. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I enjoyed it as well. And it was great to chat. A pretty wide range of topics. A lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, if you ever want to come on and plug Morningstar again, just hit me up. You got an open invite.
Oh,
so
thanks,
I appreciate
Bill.
Your time.
Yeah, likewise. All right, man. Thanks, mate. Cheers.
Nice talking to you, Daniel. Take care.
Absolutely necessary.